Thank you for formal submission, and thank you for coming in today. May I invite you to enlarge upon your written submission orally?
Certainly. I think we felt it was very important that the university contribute to this inquiry, partly because of what we've done as an institution to raise awareness and deal with issues of discrimination in a workforce and in an education provider around the issue of same-sexuality. But we also thought it was important to have our voice heard as an educational institution because of our firm belief that if universities and institutions of education don't actually proactively address issues, conceptions and perceptions around the issue of sexuality, sexual orientation, gender identity, if we don't actually start allowing people to start questioning the received wisdom and the received stereotypes and misunderstandings around sexuality and gender identity, then we'll be derelict in our duties as an education provider, and we would probably be setting Australia up for another generation of people for whom ignorance and age-old stereotypes have actually shaped their opinions. We position ourselves as an education authority who aspires to produce graduates and citizens of the globe, meaning intellectually and emotionally comfortable with difference. We want them to be, we believe that many of them will be the leaders of tomorrow, many of them will work in the international arena, and so this education aim of our strategy is of vital importance. It's interesting, really, that although the university has had in its policy environment since 1990 or 1991 the inclusion of sexual orientation, then called sexual preference, within its equal opportunity statement, it's interesting that it's really, Malcolm will talk a little bit more about this, but we were starting to get feedback that despite having a very progressive policy environment, people still continue to feel unsafe in its largest sense because of their sexual orientation or their gender identity. I'm firmly of the belief that that feeling of unsafeness has been developed and promoted because of the legalised discrimination against people of GL, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex status, because that discrimination has been allowed by society, it's been legally sanctioned. And that is actually a very powerful message that that our legislators and our society sends to GLBTI people. You don't count, it is legal to discriminate against you. You are, in many ways, second-class citizens. And as I said, I think we'd be derelict if we hadn't attempted to address that perception in society. I can continue.
Yes, please.
I think you might like to ask more questions. The university has always, well, for many years, has positioned itself as, especially in the equity area, as aspiring to good practice. And so we were also very keen to make sure that our the initiatives that we've developed were actually in place before the state legislation changed. You may be aware that Western Australia was the last state to actually amend its equal opportunity legislation and to eradicate some of the legalised discrimination against GLBTI people. It was important that we did that because it was important that we were sending a message that this was what the university aspired to. The university aspired to be creating a safe and inclusive environment for all staff and students, irrespective of personal characteristics. And we felt, really, that if our strategies, the Ally Network strategy, that if that actually was only born after the legislation changed, it could be cynically, if you like, positioned from those people who didn't like the message as merely a strategy to avoid future legal claims, if you like. The university is also very aware of its corporate social responsibility. The university was the first university in Western Australia and was the only university in Western Australia until the 1970s. It's on a very visible position on a main highway just near here. And so it's a bit of an icon in the community. And many people in Western Australia, their education, their higher education was going through UWA. So it was very important that we send a message to the community by taking this proactive action. And just incidentally, we fly the rainbow flag for a week during Pride Month, which is in October in Western Australia, and at least 50,000 cars a day go past those flagpoles. So I think that's a I'm very pleased about that as well. I'm also fond of saying that the university has a community that's in excess of 20,000, which is not big for university communities, but is big in terms of Australian communities and is larger than many country towns. So we expect within our community that there will be a whole range of opinions and attitudes. And because we had such a young school leader cohort coming into the university, we also anticipate that students coming in will be predominantly school leader age, at that vulnerable stage of their sexuality, really, if they're not given a message that your sexuality is fine, whatever it is, and your gender identity is fine, whatever it is, that they were likely to either continue to inherit the attitudes of their family and community and society. So there's been many reasons why we've been proactive in this regard. And I have to say that at one stage, there was at least 10 transgendered staff members on campus. We can talk about a high-profile intersex graduate that we've had as well. So we've had, within our community, we've had people who have agitated for, you know, have gently agitated for the university to take the reins in this matter. Would you like just to speak about some of our specific strategies?
Well, I would. Thinking about how you would be proactive in the two areas in particular that you mentioned. I can see that the university really is in a commanding position to be proactive in dealing with its staff by various staff policies and promulgates and the conditions and so on that it builds into its workplace agreements. But how do you go about conveying the desirability of inclusive attitudes to your students?
The very fact that we have, and the very fact that we have an ally network, which has the endorsement of the Vice-Chancellor and the University Executive, there's badges and signs that go with it, actually, all my badge today, and there's signs that people...
Hanging out of bed.
Yeah, right, so there's a badge, there's signs, there's bits of paraphernalia that identify you as an ally, and of course being an ally there's no selection criteria around your own identity, gender identity or sexuality to become an ally. So that's very prominently positioned as an equity initiative within the university. It's prominently positioned to new entrants, new university students. The Guild is part of the consortium that established this strategy, the Guild of Undergraduates, which is the students' voice, if you like. So they are active in promoting this strategy to the students. And then we run allied training sessions a number of times a year, and some are specifically for students. And we always get a lot of students coming along. And we work also closely with the Queer Department, which is a subset of the Guild of Undergraduates. It's a student society. So that's one way, which is that we offer the ally training and we do a lot of work around the alliance, if you like, with students. But we also, and this is, I think, of vital importance, Malcolm in particular does a lot of work in the curriculum around equity and diversity subjects. And so that Malcolm weaves, there may be that he's asked to speak specifically about sexuality, and we can talk about the Law Initiative just recently, but it's certainly the more we have access into the formal curriculum, the better position this message is. You know, it's part of the formal learning of the university. It's not in every course, obviously, and it sometimes relies on the proactivity of the academic staff member, the course coordinator. So it's by invitation that we input into the curriculum. But nevertheless, that's actually very powerful. You know, it's not
a fringe activity. I'm very interested in hearing how you might do that. For example, do you do it to medical students?
Do you do it to
engineering students?
In law students, engineering students, absolutely, the whole lot.
Perhaps we'll describe the operational stuff. Bev said the contextual background. And since UWA has been mentioned, we had it in the policy statement since the early 90s. When I was recruited in 2000, Bev's predecessor at the time, she indicated that she specifically, one of the two key areas of concern was sexuality and race. So the equity office had done a lot of work in gender, disability, and certainly had an indigenous presence that had been woefully inadequate in the other two areas. And so I guess that started from that very formative stage of recruitment. The office worked with the Guild in 2002 to develop and implement a rainbow project. So that was, if you wish, assessing the climate at UWA towards sexual diversity. And we surveyed about 850 students. We had a couple of focus groups with staff members, about a sense of where the barometer of attitudes and behaviours were around sexual diversity, and we've appended the rainbow report to the submission. Once we, the usual things like came out of the pink ceiling report, etc. A lot of senior staff, or some senior staff, felt uncomfortable about declaring their sexuality for fear of not getting promoted. Invisibility in the staff room around recognition of gay relationships, using the third person pronoun, lots of that anecdotal stuff came up in the focus group. So we tabled the rainbow report and said, well, we can't just leave it here. We've got to look at some organisational redevelopment and culture change strategies around this, which was the birth of the Ally program. So an academic who had worked at the University of Illinois said that lots of North American campuses had the Ally program. So Ben and I then worked in partnership with the Higher Education Development Unit and rolled out the first Ally program in 2002. So the Ally program, in a sense, is the more formal awareness-raising channel and mechanism. And once the allies are trained, we engage in ongoing professional development. So, for example, when we were drafting the submission, we went to all the allies. We got some feedback from the allies, and we incorporated that within the body of the submission. So there's an ongoing conversation and ongoing dialogue. In July, we had a panel with a range of, there's a transgender person, an intersex person, and diversity within the gay community. It was attended by about 30 UWA staff, so it was a great opportunity to keep the conversation going and the dialogue happening. As Ben mentioned, we invited to do guest lectures in engineering, law, social work, psychology, and I did one this morning actually in computer science, in the final year of computer science unit called Professional Computing, which basically says we don't want nerds anymore. We want much graduates with a whole range of attributes and skills. And we floated sexuality as one of the critical areas for them to be sensitized. And there was a range of really provocative questions. Bev asked me to do a session a couple of weekends ago with a group of international students. There's a peak student body, and many of them came to me after the session. It was a two-hour session on a Saturday afternoon, and they said they learned a lot from the session because they had a whole range of prejudices towards GLBTI people. So they were just, if you wish, interrogating race as an issue and had not really dealt with sexuality. So in doing having the race as well as the sexuality conversation, they could see the intersections. And so we do a lot of that work in the student body. And I guess being an EO practitioner and an out gay man as well, an out gay man of colour as well, I think for me it's very stark. There is an appetite for conversation around race, but not sexuality. It's, as someone put it, it's the last invisible prejudice. It was interesting that someone very senior at UWA at the time when we were rolling out Ally, and this person has moved considerably to the left, said to me, Malcolm, now why are we wasting time on sexuality? You know there's a lot of racism and we should be dealing with race. And should be, really marshalling our resources towards race rather than sexuality. So I think the usefulness of the Ally program has been visibility. There haven't been too many grievances or traditional EEO type complaints. You've had one or two of that, but there's numerous, lots of anecdotal evidence. We had a senior academic who came out, worked in a male-dominated area, said he saw the Ally badge on head of department's door, felt comfortable, and gave him an opportunity to talk about his sexuality in an open and own it in an honest way. Another academic we poached from Sydney said that he'd done the whole trail down the East Coast, and sexuality was always invisible. He was a white male. And he said it was great seeing our CEO talk about the Allied program at orientation. He said it was fantastic for the program to be visible. He felt safe. He felt it was comfortable. So there's a significant body of evidence showing we're evaluating it at the moment, that the program certainly is changing the culture, and we're using a champion leadership model. So we're training a critical mass of people at UWA who can then go forward and lead on this issue. As Ben mentioned, the academic in law did the Allied program and he runs a fourth year unit called Law and Contemporary Social Issues. And he this year he had gay marriage and civil unions as the key issue that they were going to examine over three lectures. So I did a lecture on sexual diversity, then ran a condensed ally session the following week. And the final week we had a panel of a diverse group of people of diverse sexualities talking about their stories and highlighting the issues raised before. So just collectively, there's a lot of conversations happening around this issue, and just as a shame, as Rod and the previous speakers would have indicated, none of the other campuses or indeed the public sector. I have friends in the public sector who say to me, that there is, apart from a policy statement, there's absolutely nothing happening in the sexuality area, and most equal opportunity units, as you know, have been all but annihilated across the public sector. So, yeah.
You said there's a significant body of evidence to support sort of the change that's occurred in, and I think you were then referring to cultural change that's occurred in UWA.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that you're able to assess running programs like this, do you think the introduction of the reform legislation in Western Australia has had an effect on the attitude of the general population in UWA in relation to its awareness and understanding of sexuality and gender issues?
Do you think the legislation, our work has actually, I think the strategies have had much more impact on the organisation than the law.
I was interested in a bit of a comment in that regard as to, whether you're in a position to assess the impact of your strategies as opposed to the impact of the law, and I know your strategies came first. That's why I thought you might be able to.
Well, only just first, actually.
Yeah,
this is how. Right. The Allied programs had taken some months to get together, and was so it was just before the law. But to give you an example, I met a staff member recently who was doing some work close to our area, and she happens to be a lesbian with a disability, had only just come to the university some months beforehand, chose to disclose the fact that she was a lesbian to us, and then worked with Malcolm in this law lecture that he just mentioned, and then chose to present herself as a lesbian woman. Now, she said she's never come out, if you like, to people who are not part of her inner circle, and that she felt very comfortable doing that, not only by perhaps the staff and the equity office, but also where she was working, who were comfortable with her, but then just feeling that it was okay to be herself in this organisation because this organisation supported her being herself. There are other stories like that, but I just felt that she's been here for a number of years living in West Australia. She's been here before the law change, she's been here after the law change. It wasn't the law that helped her to come out, if you like, or coming out sounds like a bad term, really. We choose to say that people are forced to leave their identity in the car park. And they come to work as a worker or as a student. If they don't feel validated, if they don't feel it's okay to be whoever they are, they're basically leaving part of themselves in the car park and only half of themselves at work. So she felt it was okay to be her full self, her real self, in front of a cast of thousands, many students, and with other people she didn't know, because it felt okay to do that. And that tells me that it was the environment in the organisation rather than the law that actually was, that positioned her like that.
And Graham, just it brings to mind a conversation I had just when the Allied programme was being rolled out. We were looking at doing some partnership work with the public sector agency that I won't name, and they said quite categorically, no, we're not going there, we're not touching it, not sure whether the legislation will go through or not. So basically there was no appetite at all. And I know subsequently that the legislation has gone through. They use the Equal Opportunity Commission's brochure, but apart from that they've done nothing else. What I leave here with you is a staff member. The other thing is at UWA we have a group called Connections. We have a group called Connections of a group of GOBDI staff, so we meet on a fairly regular basis from time to time when issues such as these come up. We seek their input, and one of the members of Connections says he had a long-term relationship with a Vietnam vet of 32 years, and he talked about the fact that he was completely invisible after his partner died recently of diabetes, and he highlights the areas of discrimination. So it's quite a powerful story.
Thank you.
So I will leave that with you. And he contrasts that with a recent case where apparently, a younger woman was married to a veteran for nearly like 2 or 3 weeks, and she's accessed more than $500 million in terms of benefits and whole range of stuff. So she was recognised after being in a marriage for 2 weeks, and he was technically in a marriage with a long-term 32-year relationship.
Michael, can we treat this as a public submission?
How about I caught up with him for dinner and heard his story and said, you must do something for me. How about I ask him to just...
Can we de-identify it?
No, he'll put it in, so he'll put some more detail, but he'd be happy for it to be a public submission. So how about I send it to you, if you give me your email address, I'll send it to you later on.
We'll take this, but we won't treat it as a public submission, but we would value one from him.
Yes. He is prepared, he's very political and happy to do so.
I just wanted to make another observation, which was, despite having a policy that was liberal, if you like, certainly for 1990, certainly for UWA at that time, that was a very big move, and then the law coming in, we've chosen to be much more explicit about same-sex entitlements. You know, basically the law now allows you to lodge a complaint if you've been denied parental leave just on the basis of the fact that your partner is of the same sex as you. You know, all those workplace entitlements. We could have left it like that and just said, okay, everyone's the same now, everyone gets the same entitlements, but we chose to make it more explicit in our enterprise agreement. So we described partner as, you know, including same-sex partners. We've chosen to spell out wherever we can within our official documents, such as the EB, what it means, you know. And so in parental leave, we don't call it maternity leave anymore, it's parental leave. It allows, if it's a hetero couple, allows the male to be the caring partner, you know, and take the very generous benefits that we offer of parental leave. It allows for same-sex partners. We felt it was important to go beyond just complying with the law. We felt it was important to actually sort of raise this and raise people's awareness that partner isn't just, you know, that parenting isn't just for heteros, heterosexual people, single or couple. There's been a number of ways in which we've done that. Similarly, for gender identity legislation in Western Australia, which came in around 2001, it allows you to, after being reassigned, to go back and have documents that were identified you in your birth gender change, so that it reflects your reassigned gender. And so that means that students who have been given degrees in one gender who have subsequently reassigned can come back and ask the university to issue them a new degree certificate in their reassigned preferred name. And we could have just left with that, but we actually chose to create a web page on that section of the website. We've already developed the processes for reassigned graduates to change their certificate. I mean, it's just that thing about taking it a couple of steps further than just allowing the law to say you have an entitlement. I mean, an entitlement is only, people will not access their entitlements if they feel that they're going to get the runaround or that there's a judgment or a hostility. And I think that reticence is partly because of this whole legalised discrimination against people of same-sex orientation. So I just think that there's probably many more things that UWA can do, but it's just, I think it's important that we don't just rely on the law to provide to remove discrimination.
Thank you.
I was just going to say, that's really helpful. That was one of the questions I wanted to ask you, which was, how have you, what have you done to reconfigure the workplace and the place for students, whatever you've brought the study place to. But the other thing that I wanted to ask you, and you might want to comment further on that, but the other thing that I wanted to ask you about was that you suggest in your submission that discriminatory provisions in social security law have an impact on the number of gay and lesbian students accessing tertiary education. Are there any other laws that you think compromises the access or experience of gay and lesbian students in the context of tertiary education?
Well, certainly the tertiary education one came up from our queer department at UWA.
You mean social security?
Social security, yeah. But in other respects,
the crowd's being asked again. I think was that relating to social security access by students?
Yes.
I think it's to do with the fact that, from what I understand from the queer department.
No, that wasn't a question so much.
I
understand social security impact because you said that in your submission.
Yeah.
My question was, are there any other laws that impact on education? Because our inquiry is about financial and work-related benefits. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to tease out is, particularly because I think this is the only university submission that we've received, whether there are other laws which, in UWA's view, impact on education for students in gay or lesbian relationship.
I can't think of any other, Graham, but in terms of the provision of education, I can't really think of any. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that.
No. But that's what, you know, we're trying to do that sort of audit, so that's why I'm asking you, because...
Just to go slightly off your question, there's a whole issue around the census that happened last night and whether it recognises intersex. I know this is beyond the terms of your reference. At UWA, many of our forms now have male, female, and either sometimes it's other, please specify, or just, you know, please specify. And the ABS, I think, is going to do that in the next census, even though they've already agreed to change that. But it's that thing about whether your identity, whether you're recognised, whether there's an opportunity in any whatever law or in whatever form for your true self to be recognised, you know?
No, I take that point.
Yeah.
It's the affirmation versus the reassignment.
Yep, take that point.
Okay. Can I take you back to the ALICE program? It sounds very interesting. How do you enrol allies in the first place? Are they all academic staff or staff, or students involved also in the program?
Well, it's a combination of both. Essentially, what we're hoping to have is university-wide coverage. So we, primarily at the Crawley side, but we've got hospitals and we've got the presence of Fremantle as well. While we obviously don't said explicitly, there is obviously a preference given the philosophical underpinning of the model, which is heterosexual people in alliance to GLBDI people. So obviously there is a preference for allies to be identifying as heterosexual. So we look primarily at faculty coverage and site coverage. We look at a mix of academic and general staff, a variety of levels, as well to look at leadership issues.
And students as well?
Students as well. So we run two ally sessions, primarily for staff, one in each semester, and two for the student body. So we work with the Guild and Student Services. And on occasion, we get specific faculties requesting that we run a session with students, as the law faculty did. So we trained 24 allies as part of their course requirements.
But then beyond having the capacity to go and give a training course or a unit within a curriculum, I take it you also encourage these people to either wear a badge or somehow or other publicise the fact that they have that particular standing.
Yeah, it's also just the first ally session was by invitation, so a range of key people in the university, including the then Deputy Vice Chancellor, were invited to attend the inaugural ally training session. So that was a strategic decision. Obviously, we wanted leaders, natural leaders, positional leaders, to be part of the flagship program. Since then, it's people volunteer. We promote that we're going to have an allied training program, and people put their hand up. So it's not dragooning people. It's not saying you must have a requisite number of allies in every area. And it's made us look at the participant list for next week for our next program, and it's a very interesting range of people from, as you can imagine, the university has many many fields of endeavour. We've got 9 faculties, wide coverage of the disciplines, many areas of activity, but workshops, and like I said, we work in the hospitals and clinicians. And so it's a fascinating mix, and we get a fascinating mix of people within the coming to the training sessions, which is excellent.
And just the other point is we coordinate a group of equity and diversity advisors, so they were the old sexual and racial harassment contact officers. We collapsed the two into one scheme called the Equity Advisor Scheme. So this year, for the first time, we actually dedicated a whole morning to sexual diversity and trained them up. And 3 have been allocated as having specific expertise in the area of sexuality. So it's beyond just ally. We roll out sexuality and sexual diversity awareness training right across a range of other programs as well.
But it's not just to make people aware. It's actually about, Alliance is about sensitivity towards GLBTIs and intersexuals, I suppose. Sensitivity towards an alliance with. But it's been an interesting initiative in that it's thrown up natural leaders. I'll just give you an example. The Faculty of Engineering, as you can imagine, is predominantly male. Has its own culture, and the student cohort is predominantly male as well. And they have a full faculty meeting once a year, and I'm invited each year to do a presentation. But before I did my presentation, the dean got up and did his thing, and immediately flashed up the wonderful ally sign that we've got up onto the screen, the overhead projector, and said, "I'm an ally. This is what the ally program's about. I'd encourage other people to be allies. It's a really important initiative. It's an important initiative in this faculty." And it's that sort of leadership that we're seeing in many different ways. That it's not just being driven by the equity office, which is a tiny little office.
Yeah.
And it's not just being driven by the zealots, the committed. Yeah. It's finding its own leadership. That sort of proactivity has led to many forms of leadership servicing.
And are you driving the same sort of program for race, or the race?
We're doing a different program for race. Certainly, a lot of input into the curriculum that Malcolm spoke to earlier. We do that around race. I believe that different sort of strategies actually required for a race alliance. But we do other things around race.
Your equity and diversity office is a part of the management structure that operates across the whole university. It's not faculty, but...
No. We're central. We're called central. Part of central administration.
And are you in effect the equivalent of some of the departments in other universities, which are ethics, equity, and so on?
Yeah, it's just to tell you, Badger. We probably don't go specifically into ethics. It's not in our title. Certainly, social justice is part of the work we do. We see that we have a responsibility to work with the community, external to UWA as well as internal. We're similarly situated to probably other bodies that you've seen in other universities.
Is there a university policy to try and include these diversity issues that you've been describing into the curriculum of each of the...
It's not so much policy, Commissioner, it's actually, we have aspirations as a teaching and learning management plan, as operational priorities plans, all of those usual governance documents. And certainly within our strategic plan, and in the highest documents of the university, we speak about the graduate attributes, we speak about citizens of the globe. So it's what that means, is what we've been working on, really. I mean, how you translate that aspiration with a high level and very broad. How do you actually ensure that your graduates do have the right attributes to become citizens of the globe? And part of that's cultural competence, some of that's the capacity to sort of make ethical judgments, the capacity to sort of relate to people from a diversity of people, to recognise that you're not the centre of the universe. So it's that thing about, that's where we see, that's what we see that we're doing when we put it in particular. But it's important that it's not just in the curriculum, because our vice-chancellors quite keen to say, and says it quite often, if you leave here at UWA with only a degree, we've failed you. If you leave here with a network of people, no. And so we believe that the student experience isn't just the formal curriculum, it's everything else. And so
the attributes that you mentioned are common, I think, to most strategic plans in universities. and I take you off on a tangent which is not directly relevant to this inquiry, but to tell you that your counterpart at the University of Queensland has recently approached me saying that she thinks that Kerioc ought to expand its work that's done in primary and secondary schools and the curriculum support materials that we've got there into the tertiary level, because she feels that the attributes are not being sufficiently addressed in the curricula of universities. And I hear you saying, absolutely. The difficulty from the Kerioc point of view is to work out how usefully we might contribute to that exercise. And I would be very interested if you think that a public institution such as ours has a role and can be usefully
certainly
applied, and how.
Well, I just look to... it could be that you're working in conjunction with the ABCC, the Australian Vice Chancellor's Committee. They put out guidelines that go to the disability standards. They've got the standards around student disability. Yeah. I mean, they put out guidelines that the sector looks at, and we certainly look at, and we've certainly done some work to try and align our practices with some of those guidelines from the ABCC. I do know the person you're speaking to, and she did put a call out in the national email list for people like us, are talking about graduate attributes, and there are some similarities and there are some differences, and I think all of the universities are in some way positioning themselves to focus on graduate outcomes and reduce employability and graduate attributes, just because of the changing face of higher education, and it's about you're as good as what you graduate, you know, you're as good as your graduates and where their first job is, you know. So it's about positioning this oneself well to realise that this isn't just a piece of paper, it's actually the students have to be much bigger than just someone who's swallowed a whole course formally, if you like. I don't know that universities take well to being directed from on high, since that's been happening so much recently. In the higher education sector, yeah. But I would have thought that actually some work with ABCC might be very productive in that.
Well, I mean, that was one of the suggestions that we made. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We've the office has just rolled out a DEMA-funded program, the Living in Harmony grants, and we looked at embedding cultural diversity and race awareness using a whiteness model across four faculties. So it was a really interesting exercise, looking at the notion of white privilege and looking at dismantling racism and promoting cultural sensitivity through the lens of privilege. And we're currently producing a race and cultural diversity manual for use in the wider tertiary sector as a tool. So, I mean,
the privilege paradigm works as well for other
issues
of identity. And so, again, heterosexual privilege, which goes to the heart of your inquiry, that if you're heterosexual, you're entitled to certain automatic acceptance of society and the financial benefits, like the DVA example that I've been using before. And we get people to look at the privilege they have just by virtues of accidents of birth, if you like, accidents of skin colour, orientation, whatever. And that's what I mean about we want our students, our graduates, to recognise that they're not the centre of the universe, and that, that other habits of mind, other ways of being, other attitudes, other belief systems have as much validity as their own.
Sorry, I've taken you off on a bit of a tangent and we've gone over time, but that was very useful.
Yeah, thank
you very much for your contribution. And as Graham said, it's good to get a submission from a university.
That's about
that. Very useful. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.